Golf Smarter number 603 is brought to you by SmarterPodcasts.com, home of Golf Smarter, Good Dog, the affordable housing podcast by Eden Housing, Powerful Insights by Protivity, and Radio Baseball Cards. Now, each week during this baseball season, we've been featuring the greatest baseball players of the 20th century, sharing amazing and amusing stories from their lives in the game. Radio Baseball Cards will continue through the playoff until the end of the World Series. And in October, we're going to hear some remarkable reflections of postseason play. But this month, we're going to hear some of the craziest stories you've ever been told about what's happened on the ball field. Stories about fans berating players, owners doing very strange tricks on the field, a player being involved in a plane hijacking, and more. So please check out Radio Baseball Cards, hosted by Don Drysdale, and Good Dog, hosted by Joanne Green, from wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Get solid, consistent, predictable contact and improve your wedge play from 50 yards and in with Tim Yelverton.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Tim.
Fred, thank you for having me.
It's a joy to have you here because you came highly recommended from somebody who just featured on the show a couple episodes ago, Brandon DeVore.
Yeah, Brandon's a good guy. I've gotten to know him fairly well over, I guess, almost the past 9 or 10 months now, last fall. And he came to Mississippi to Old Waverly Golf Club where I teach. And we did a little work together, and then he had me out in Long Beach just a few weeks ago. So we did some work there, and we're putting together a video series, a short game video series. And we've had a couple schools and clinics and things like that. So yeah, so we've spent a lot of time together here recently.
Oh well, no wonder you came highly recommended. You guys are partners.
That's right. he's fun. We complement each other well. He knows what he's doing with the video inside of it. He's, you know, I think he would say himself that he's somewhat of a golf junkie. He loves golf. There's no doubt about it.
That was clear.
So we fit well together for
That's
sure.
Nice. That's nice. Do you work with any other PGA touring professionals?
Yeah, I work with Jonathan Randolph, who's on the PGA Tour. Allie McDonald and Sydney Clanton. They're both on the LPGA Tour. I worked with Kevin Kisner and Scott Brown we worked for about 3 years together. Their full swing coach and their main coach is John Tillery, and he and I are good friends, and he asked me to come in and help them out with some putting and short game stuff. And so we worked together from 2014, 15, and 16. We worked together for about 3 years. Yeah.
Well, you said the magic words, putting and short game. That's what I'm so glad that we're here to talk about today, because I don't think that it's concentrated on enough. It's weird. After doing this podcast for 12 years now, some things are finally becoming clear to me, and I still don't know how clear they are. But I've changed my warm-up. I don't get a chance to practice all that much. And when I do, it's only my short game. I don't work on my swing mechanics. I just work on short targets. But I'm also realizing that, you know, when I go to play a round, I generally like to get to the course an hour early. I know that's really hard for so many people to do. I've got some luxuries in my work schedule that allow me to do that. But I just, when I'm playing golf, I really want to focus on it. And I need that time, because if I don't warm up, it feels like I'm testing out my swing all through the round. So I want to, when I get to the first tee, I want to feel like, okay, I know what's happening with my clubs somewhat. But, boy, that was too long. So what I've just recently started to do and I realize is that I'll put about 25, maybe 30% into my swing when I warm up, and the rest of the time is all short game. It's either putting, chipping around the green, doing my pick shot, doing my lob wedge, but everything really like 50 yards and in. I don't do a whole lot more, and it's been paying off dividends. My scores have been dropping lately, and I'm shocked.
Well, yeah, and you know, everybody knows that putting is depending on the player, obviously, but about 40% of your score. And then when you start counting for chips and pitches and bunker shots, and then maybe even throw in a wedge shot or two, it's well over 60%. Your total score. Yeah, absolutely. And so many people, the driver's important. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the guys that we see week in and week out at the top of the leaderboard, there'll be a few exceptions, but for the most part, they really do hit it a long way. There's no doubt about it.
Okay, so the few exceptions, we're both thinking about Jordan Spieth on number 13 with that drive at the Open Championship, right? I mean, that was the most amazing bad shot that I've ever seen. But
I think they're going to actually put a plaque there.
Oh, yeah, they should. Yeah. Forget the plaque. There should be a course. There should be a semester-long, if not a year-long course on those last five holes and how to get yourself out of trouble.
Yeah, he did an amazing job. He's been doing it for a while, and it goes back to the way he trained and practiced when he was a junior golfer with Cameron and McCormick. And I mean, they've obviously done a great job, you know, learning how to score, whether you're hitting it great or just trying to manage around, you know, getting it in the hole.
Yeah, but anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted, and I'm real good at that. You were talking about the driver is so important, but
yeah, I mean it is. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, it's the one club that most players are going to hit 14 times around, occasionally a 3-wood or a hybrid. But for the most part, you know, we are going to hit a lot of drivers, and it does set up the way the hole is played. But then after that, you know, inside of 30, 50 yards, you know, if you have a shot 50, 60 yards from the hole, you probably chose to be there. You know, usually our misses are not going to be that far from the hole. And then our layups and par fours are usually going to be outside of that distance. So if somebody's on a time crunch, you know, the last thing they really need to do is go hit 70, 60, and 50 yarders, but they should really concentrate that time inside of 50, because most of our misses are going to be within about 90 feet of the hole, you know, and that's 30 yards. So, I mean, so a lot of time does need to be sort of allocated for those 30, 40 yards in, just like you were saying.
Yeah. Where do you start with that? Where do with the whole concept of turning three shots into two, and you're teaching this, you know, do you start at the putting green or do you start back in the fairway, or in my case, in the rough?
Yeah, I mean that's a great question. It's player dependent. You know, it depends on some players chip better, some players putt better. Ultimately, scrambling percentage, if you think of it just scrambling percentage, is usually proximity, honestly. It's the ability to chip it 3 feet or 4 feet from the hole rather than 8 or 9 feet from the hole. We all know that tour players, the very best players in the world, only make 50% of their 8-footers. So, but they make over 90% of their 4-footers. So it's just that little bit of cleaner contact or landing in a slightly better spot or hitting it just a touch higher or lower. Those are the pieces that ultimately dictate whether we get it on the green and two putt or get it on the green and then make the putt and save that par or make a birdie on a par five. So I would say for the most part, chipping and pitching are more important than putting to have a better scrambling percentage. Now, obviously that varies from player to player, but for the masses, I would say, if you want to, you know, improve your scrambling, learn to chip it and pitch it just a step or two closer to the hole.
And I need to do this because there's a debate that goes on our rounds. Can you please define scrambling for me so I can repeat it?
You know, I would say anytime that you miss the green in regulation and you have a chance to make par, that would be scrambling. Can you get it on the green and in the hole in two shots?
Okay,
That's how I would define
okay.
scrambling.
So shooting par, but not being on the green in regulation.
Right.
Okay. So up and down is one putt. Doesn't matter where your score is. You could be one putt for double bogey as long as you're off the green, on the green, and one putt. Is that up and down?
I think so. I think. You know, I know, like, I know some of the different stats apps and programs that you can use. They have them separate, up and down percentage and scrambling percentage. You know, honestly, and kind of in my world, I don't care if the player lies two by the green or four. I want them to get it on the green and in the hole in two shots.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Chipping and pitching is more important than putting. Let's start with your lob wedge. Mm-hmm. Some people shouldn't have one in their bag. At least a friend of mine said, I was playing with a caddy recently, and he told me, don't take out your 60 degree. Just leave it in your bag or leave it at home. Comments?
People are scared to death of their lob wedge. You know, there are a lot of people that just refuse to hit it. Ultimately, the only difference in a lob wedge and a sand wedge is obviously loft and a little bit different sole as far as bounce is concerned. Generally speaking, sand wedges have more bounce. They're a little easier not to hit fat. The lob wedge typically has a little less bounce, and obviously it has more loft. You know, in the video series that we did, we start with contact and really focus on making sure the player has solid, consistent, predictable contact. And then from there, once a player has really good contact, then it's all about managing loft and speed. So with a lob wedge, you obviously have more loft delivered to the golf ball, so therefore you need more speed, club head speed, delivered to the golf ball to make it go the same distance, as opposed to maybe having a 52 that you would deliver less loft, therefore you need less speed. And I always go, that's always part two. So I always address contact with a player, because if contact is inconsistent, then we literally have no idea how hard to swing. And we know, because we don't know if the ball is going to come out fast or slow, if it's going to come out low or high. So we're completely guessing. So contact is always at the top of the food chain or the hierarchy as far as short game is concerned.
Yeah. Contact is king, huh?
Absolutely.
In my business, I've always said content is king, but I can understand where contact would be king too.
Exactly.
Solid, consistent, predictable contact. But I got to believe that more than 75% of your students, first thing they're asking for is more consistency.
Yes, that's what everybody wants. Everybody wants to be more consistent. Yeah. And you know, when people say, oh, look at Fred or look at Jim, he's got such great touch, such great feel. Ultimately, that's where we're trying to go to. That's what we're trying to achieve, but we can't really achieve that unless we have consistent contact, and because that dictates how fast the ball is coming out. And then from there, then we figure out, okay, well, I want to land it in this spot with this certain trajectory that matches up. So yeah, everybody wants to be more consistent. But I played basketball. That was kind of my other sport growing up, so I use a lot of basketball examples.
Sure.
But if we didn't know how much a basketball weighed until after we shot it, it would be impossible, right?
Yeah.
So if one time it's full of feathers, the next time it's full of lead. One time we'd shoot it over the backboard, the next time we'd shoot it, you know, 2 feet in front of us, right?
Right.
So it's kind of that way in the short game. So if you don't know how solid you're about to hit this golf ball, then you have no idea what speed the ball is about to come out. So you have no idea how hard to swing. So I would say that contact is probably minimum 80% of the short game. I mean, if contact is good, we all know how to hit it a little higher or a little lower. And then most players that have played golf for just a small amount of time have a pretty good idea of where to land. So once we kind of tidy up contact and make it consistent, then we have a very good handle on the short game.
I was, a friend of mine said the other day, he's like, I just need to be more consistent. I said, well, let me ask you a question. Tell me about your scoring. How, what's your scoring been lately? He goes, oh, I'm in the upper 80s, low 90s, pretty much all the time. I said, then aren't you consistent? And he goes, well, no, that's not, I mean, like ball hitting consistent. I said, but you are, if you're scoring the same, pretty much, how much do you practice on this? He goes, practice? I don't have time to practice. I said, then what are you complaining about? You're playing pretty well then, I would think. Confidence and contact. You just said contact is 80%. Does that only leave 20% for confidence? I mean, where does confidence come? You know, because to me, I can make that contact, but if I think I'm in a hard pan, or if there's an uneven lie in the grass, or it's in a divot or something, all of a sudden my confidence starts to disappear.
And here's how I always teach and coach players is we build a motion that would work off of just a flat fairway cut lie. Okay, so that's their base motion. And then from that base motion, then once that's consistent, then I'll teach them and coach them to understand how to hit more down on it or less down on it. Okay, so they'll shallow or steepen their strike. If you think about, I always use the example of landing an airplane on a runway. So, you know, you have the runway here, the airplane's coming down at about 3 degrees. All right, that would be our flat fairway cut lie. Now, when the airplane, if an airplane was coming in to land and the runway shifted like this, the airplane could still land. It would just have to shallow its approach to regain that 3 degrees. Vice versa, if it was coming in like this, the runway shifted this way, it'd be fine. You just have to steepen your approach to regain your 3 degrees. So really, that's what we're doing when we have a ball on a downslope, when we have a ball in a hard pan, upslope, into the grain, soft lies, firm lies, balls buried in the rough or balls sitting up on 3 inches of zoysia. You know, so all the time, that's what makes the short game, one, challenging. And in my opinion, it's what makes it fun, because we have to always adapt. Where a tee shot, you know, you're adapting curve, but you're always on a flat lie. You get to tee it up as high as you want to. So you kind of set the stakes there, right? Where the short game, you know, you very rarely do you ever have the same shot in a tournament, much less in a round, you know? Yeah. So that's what I think is so fun about it is kind of adapting and then sort of improvising. Cause I mean, it definitely brings out the creative side of the player.
Yeah. Yeah. And you really, until you start feeling comfortable with your tools, and we'll just say your lob wedge or whatever, you know, pitching wedge. So you start, you know, the creativity part is still a way off. I mean, it's hard to get creative if you really don't have good control in your mind of what's going on with that club.
Yeah, you can see it all day, but if you can't, if you don't have the skills to hit it, right, you still can't hit the shot. Right. And that, you know, and that's where, like, when you were talking about the confidence from the hard pan or whatever lie it may be, once you're able to hit the base shot, then it's just a matter of understanding how to implement a steeper strike or a shallower strike, depending on what lie you have in front of you. And then, obviously, you have to try it out in practice to get the feel for it before you try it in competition, or maybe not. You know, it depends on what you want to do. But that being said, and then it's just a progression. You know, you sort of learn vanilla, right? And then from there, then you sprinkle on some chocolate syrup, and then you go with, you know, with some rainbow sprinkles and some whipped cream or whatever you want on there. But you always start with vanilla, and then you just build on top from there.
That was the best analogy I've ever heard. The best metaphor, using ice cream. I want to apologize to our podcast listeners on audio only. Tim was explaining it to me. It made total sense what he was saying about the angles because he was using his hands and I was watching it. This video, I'm recording this on video and, of course, on audio. And the video is available on our YouTube channel at Golf Smarter TV. So if you want to see what his hands were doing to explain that a little better, then please check that out. One of the other things that I find so interesting and hard to, I don't want to use the word master, get comfortable with, is how high I want, like, say I'm between 10 and 20 yards off the green, okay? And the flag is either the middle or the back. Let's not talk about a front flag at this point. How high do I want to get the ball in the air and close to the pin in the air? Or how low do I want to keep it and how long do I want to let it roll? How do I figure out what I want to do with that? Because that one, I think, so many people, I think, are lobbing to try to get as close to the hole as they possibly can. And I've seen that and I've done it, when that really isn't going to help, because if it doesn't get all the way to the hole and, you know, and just take a short roll and it releases. Now all of a sudden I'm 20 feet past the hole.
Right. There's a couple ways that I tell players to do that, and especially like new players mm-hmm. or players that don't get to play a lot or younger juniors that are relatively new. Sometimes they don't like options because then they don't really know, should I land it here with a lower trajectory or fly it farther with a higher trajectory? What I tell juniors, young juniors, is like, I'm like, all right, take two balls. The first one from right here where this ball is, let's just say we have, just to give it some numbers, let's say we have 5 steps of fringe or rough, and then we have 15 steps of green. So it's a 20-yard shot total. I say, okay, you can land this ball anywhere you want to. Just toss it over there and make it stop by the hole. Mm-hmm. Well, all of them underhanded will roll and land it, maybe 3 steps, 4 steps, 5 at the most onto the green. None ever throw it more than halfway. And then it rolls up somewhere around the hole. And I'm like, okay, so that's more of the type of shot you should play. So that sort of gives them just the visual of like, okay, if I could toss this ball any way I wanted to and land it anywhere I want to, how would I do that? No one would ever try to, since we have 20 yards, no one ever tries to throw it 17 yards, real high and try to stop it. They all land it halfway or even a little short of halfway and let it roll because we innately understand that's the best way to make the ball stop where we want it to stop and land where we want it to land. The second way I tell players to do that, and some people love this next one, some people hate it, but it's kind of goes with brain type of thing. But anyway, is sort of have a baseline. When you go out to the chipping green, find a nice flat chip where it's not a big upslope or downslope, and fly your sand wedge 10 yards, and then see how far it rolls. And then fly your gap wedge 10 yards, see how far it rolls. Pitching wedge 10 yards. And then you have a baseline for, okay, under these conditions, obviously they can change with firmness of the green and speed and things like that. But if I fly at 10, how far does it roll? And then you have a baseline for understanding, okay, my 52 is kind of my 10 to 10. If I fly at 10, it'll roll 10. So that sort of gives you a baseline to base everything off of. And maybe you had a bunker in between you and the hole and you have to fly at 15 and roll 5. Well, then you obviously know it's the lob wedge. Vice versa, if you want to fly at 5 and roll 15, then depending on the player, it's probably somewhere around an 8 iron. So, but that gives them something sort of concrete rather than – because sometimes people don't like options. When they see all that green between them and the hole, they don't like that. They'd rather just say, tell me what to do. So that's a good way to just establish a nice baseline for 10 yards in the air, how far did it roll? You can't really do it into 30 and 40 yards because then every club, like a sand wedge is never going to roll – farther than it flew at 40 yards,
Okay. Do you subscribe to the notion of getting the ball onto the green as quickly, onto the flat surface as quickly as possible and just let it roll for as long as you can, as opposed to keeping it there?
Most of the time, yes. Occasionally, there's easier landing spots. Hmm. Land in that are more conducive to the shot, but for the most part, yeah. I mean, it's like throwing a ball. If you're trying to throw it and land it at a certain place, it's easier to throw it on a line than it is to lob it. Think about a quarterback trying to throw it over the linebackers and short of the safety. That's a hard pass. They'd rather throw it on a line straight across. And so golf's the same way with wedges. Tour players launch their wedges pretty low for as high as they actually hit the golf ball in the full swing, and the reason why, it's more predictable. So it's more predictable where the ball is going to land rather than the one that shoots straight up and then straight down. Tour players hit it very high with their full swing, but they actually flight their wedges quite low. And you can all, not always, but most of the time, you can really kind of give wedge handicaps just purely by launch. The better the player, you can almost say the better the player, the lower they launch it.
Really?
Tour players are going to launch it somewhere around 30, where I would say that maybe just that your average guy that shoots 82 probably launches it upwards of the upper 30s, maybe sometimes even 40. Yeah, they definitely launch it higher.
Wow. I love the idea of figuring out one shot, but with different clubs. You know, it's like as opposed to taking, okay, I'm going to take this club and I'm going to hit it 60 yards. I'm going to take this club and I'm going to hit it 80 yards. I'm going to take this club and hit it 90 yards, right? As opposed to, okay, I got a 40-yard shot or a 45, 50-yard shot or even a 30-yard shot. Now I'm going to try three different clubs. I'm going to practice three different clubs just at that distance. I think that that's just a great idea. I've been lately been doing a lot of that with my, like my mid irons is like how, you know, not only how far and what's my trajectory on a normal shot, but how low can I pitch that? And how far, if I get a good pitch, cause there's a lot of trees here and I seem to be under them most of the time. How low can I keep that club down and how far will it go? So I know how I can get myself out of trouble and how much, you know, so I don't chip it all the way to the other side of the fairway because I'm just trying to get out of these trees.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big fan of, like I said earlier, I always start with contact with players. Mm-hmm. And then once contact is really good, then we move into like a, what I call a three ball practice. So they'll take the same club, drop three balls and then hit the same club to the same target with three different combinations of trajectory and spot, which is ultimately loft and speed. So they'll hit a low one and then they'll hit a medium shot, then they'll hit a high shot. And that really creates touch. It creates imagination, feel, visualization, things like that. But ultimately it helps the player understand how much loft they're delivering to the golf ball and then how much speed they need to match it up to make all three balls go the same distance with ultimately different speeds and different lofts. So that's pretty much part two of a typical practice plan. If somebody came in for a golf lesson, that would be their second part of their practice plan.
So when you are working with a student and you know that you need to start, you need to work on their short game, but they do need some help on their mechanics. If they only come in, and I'm sure a lot of people just come in for a lesson because they need, you know, oh, I'm going on vacation this week and I'm playing golf three times and I haven't played in 6 months, so I need a lesson. What do you focus on? Do you work on their short game at that point? Do you tell them, listen, let's just forget about your other clubs. Let's just go short game. Or it's like, let's tinker with your swing, which is really going to screw them up, right?
Yeah. And what we do at Old Waverly, it's all I do is teach short game. So I teach all putting and short game. VJ Trolio teaches all the full swing lessons. Okay. So it's, if they're coming to me, they're working on that anyway. Now, if I were teaching full swing as well, I would tell them, you know, spend a little bit of time with the driver because we know that is going to affect how they play. And then from there, yeah, let's work on contact in our short game, and let's work on distance control and putting. So I might break an hour lesson into 20-20-20, 20 minutes on the driver, 20 with contact around the green, and then 20 making sure that their touch, their distance control is really good with their putting, because that's obviously, we know how many strokes we can gain or lose there.
Okay. Let's talk about putting for a while, green reading. What are you familiar with Jeff Mangum's work?
Somewhat, yes. I'm very familiar with Mark Sweeney and Aimpoint.
Aimpoint?
Yeah. And I know who Jeff is. I don't know him personally, but I know some of his green reading stuff and putting stuff, yes.
Yeah, well, he's been on the show many years, but he hasn't been on many years, and he will be coming back to talk about putting in a few episodes. Are you an Aimpoint enthusiast?
Yes, I think it's great.
Yeah,
I
mean, we had Sweeney on a long time ago, but we did have him on to talk about it. But explain it, please.
Sweeney's awesome. I've known him for, I think I got certified back in like 2009. So it was really, really new when it first came out. And it's gone through version, it's probably about the third or fourth version now. And Aimpoint Express is what everybody's really familiar with because they're seeing guys like, you know, Adam Scott and things like that, players on TV using it. It is very easy in the sense that, and it's quick, and that's why it's called Express. It's about all about tilt and time. You know, it's about how much side tilt do I have, and how long is it going to take the golf ball to get to the hole?
Explain side tilt. Wait, side tilt is
in the green. So if the green's tilted left or right,
okay,
and then And then how much time is it going to take the ball to get to the hole?
So that's versus up or down going forward, right. And it's left or right tilt. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so thank you. If you had a 10-footer downhill and I had a 10-footer uphill and we both hit the balls at exactly the same time, the uphill putt would get there way before the downhill putt would because you got to hit it harder.
Right? Oh, okay. Yeah. I was like, wait a minute. Gravity's in the way.
Things counterintuitive. Yeah. Everybody gets that mixed up. Yeah. They're like, well, the downhill putt's faster, so it'll get there faster. But you have to hit it softer, right. Slower. So it takes more time. Therefore, a downhill putt is always on the same amount of tilt is going to break more than the uphill putt because of time. Same tilt, different time. And that's the same thing with green speeds. So, if we tee off in the round, and the greens are rolling an 11, and then we have a 2-hour rain delay. We go out and they're rolling a 9. Well, now the same putts break less because the greens are slower, because now we're going to have to hit them harder. Therefore, it's just like the uphill putt. The ball gets to the hole faster. It breaks less. So tilt and time is what Aimpoint Express is all about, and those are the two big factors that really dictate how much the putt's going to break.
Okay. So I need more help with this. I'm kind of lost.
With feet. Yeah. Let me go with feet. All right. So when you see players facing their target line, okay. What they're doing is they face their target line and they're literally trying to feel how much they're trying to assess the side tilt. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's 1%. Maybe it's 2%. 2% is pretty average. The USGA doesn't put hole locations above 3. So if you're inside of 20 feet, you're probably not going to be greater than a 3. Occasionally it will happen.
3 degrees of tilt. Of
3%.
3%
of tilt. Yeah. And so most of the time, if you watch the guys and girls you see on TV, they're going to be holding up ones and twos. You have a lot of ones and twos. And that, so if the putt were breaking to the right, let's just say it's a 2% tilt. You would hold your two fingers up and you would put, so when you hold the fingers up like this, if it's breaking right, well, then you put the right side of your fingers at the center of the cup, and then the left side of the fingers is where you would aim. And that tells you how much the putt's going to break.
Okay.
Now, as the green gets faster, well, then you can change your arm bend, and that kind of dictates that's time. So is the faster the green is, the more you would bend your arm, and the slower the green, the more you'd straighten your arm. But it's really super simple, and it's amazingly effective. It really is, and it gives players a very educated area to aim and try to start their ball. And then obviously the execution is still – we still have to learn. Even if we know every read 100% correct, we still have to execute it. But, yeah, it's very good, and it's very simple.
I guess it only makes sense that there's always going to be some sort of percentage of angle on a green, because you can't really have a flat green because of water needs to be coming off
That's
of
right.
it, right? It's about irrigation. Is there anything, is there anything, how come these words aren't coming out? I really have the sentence in my mind and it's not working. is there such a thing as a flat putt?
Yes. Now it might be, there's definitely straight putts. So every hole location will have at least two straight putts. Mm-hmm. Now you may be putting straight in uphill or straight in downhill. So if you think about if you have a watch on, look at your watch or a clock on the wall, 12 o'clock would be straight in downhill.
Okay.
And then 6 o'clock would be straight in uphill. Okay, so you're going to have two putts that are straight. All right, now from there, there's 360 degrees in the clock. 90 degrees is going to be your biggest breaking putt because you're truly putting straight across that slope, right? Mm-hmm. So 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock, those are max break putts. And then every degree from when you go from 3 to 6, as you move down towards it, the putt breaks less and less and less because you have less side tilt. So then once you get to 6, there is no side tilt. Now there is tilt, but it's straight uphill. And then 12 is straight downhill. So technically there's no left, right tilt or side, but there is tilt uphill, downhill. I mean, I guess technically there's probably some spots on greens that are just completely flat. But like you said, they got to figure out some way to get water off of them. Yeah. Right. So if they are flat, there's probably not a lot of grass there. Or not for long anyway.
Right, right. Should we be confident that the practice putting green is going to be similar in speed to the rest of the holes on the course?
You know, at tour events, this is usually the fastest spot, just because there's so much traffic. The practice green gets really fast. Sometimes I've seen clubs where the practice green's actually a little slower. It just depends. I mean, yeah, you're right. Sometimes the practice green is not very indicative of what you're about to go putt on. And then sometimes it's exactly the same. The beauty with Aimpoint Express is you can, once you get on the golf course, if you see that you're missing your putts high consistently through the first two or three holes, well, then just straighten your arm. You know, don't bend it so much. That'll decrease the break, and then you can kind of form or adapt to that, and vice versa. If you're missing putts low, you're not playing enough break, therefore you need to bend your arm more, and that will then increase the break. So that's one of the beauties of Aimpoint Express, is that it's very flexible.
Awesome.
But yeah, I agree with what you said. Sometimes the practice green is not what you're about to go play on.
Yeah. I want to go more into what we should do on the practice green, but I had another question first about using your putter off the green. I know there's, you know, the what is it, Texas wedge? Right? If you're on the first cut, or you're on the second cut, or you're 10 feet off, how smart is it to use your putter in those instances versus, I like using my 8-iron when I'm on the fringe at all, just to give it a little bit, you know, over that, because then it's, to me, it's more predictable, right?
Yeah.
What's your feeling about that?
A lot of it depends on where you play. If you play and it's pretty firm and there's not a lot of grain, I would putt a lot. In the south, in Mississippi, where I am, there's a lot of grain, especially if you're going up, like into an upslope on the green. So the grass is going to grow back into you. That's really hard to putt into, unless they cut it really, really close. Like in South Florida, in the Florida Swing on tour, when they play at Honda, when they play at TPC, things like that, there's a lot of grain, but it's cut so tight, players don't want to chip a lot on that because it's very unforgiving. So yeah, that's a great time to putt. You know, when you're playing and you have a lot of rough, obviously you can't really putt through that. So it depends on the conditions around. But the more friction that's going to be on that golf ball, by grass or by grain or by slope, you might want to start trying to get it in the air. If you have a nice little down slope, this down grain, maybe it's kind of firm, I mean, putt it all day, right? So the more that the lie of the land is trying to stop the ball, the more you probably need to chip. The more that everything's going with you, you know, if you have a little down slope, down grain, 7 or 8 feet of fringe, you know, putt it all day. Absolutely. Because it goes back to what we were saying about, go ahead and get the ball on the ground, get it lower, get it rolling. It's more predictable. And then, you know, the outcome will be better most of the time.
I was blown away in watching the Open Championship of how far these guys were using their putter from when they were off the green. But I guess links courses like that, the whole course is like an ice skating rink, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, that's exactly right. You know, like just like I was saying about friction, there is no friction. I mean, there's some.
Very
basically,
little.
There's none. So there's nothing to stop the ball. So why get in there? Just go ahead and let it putt.
Yeah.
We actually just built another golf course right across the street from Old Waverly, Mossy Oak Golf Club. And it's a link style design. And it's amazing how firm and fast and tight everything is around those greens. Hmm. And those greens are designed literally for players to bounce balls into. It's 180 degrees different from Old Waverly. It's more, a little more traditional golf course in the States, where it's softer in front. It's more, you know, fly the ball to where you want it to stop. But it's really fun because you can play one afternoon at each course and have two completely different golf experiences.
I know you have to go because you have a lesson that started 2 minutes ago, but please, can you give me your favorite? I wanted to have more time for this, and I'm sorry, maybe we'll get you back on to do that. Give me your favorite warm-up drill for putting. Putting warm-up drills.
Putting.
Yeah. So am I going to be working on my line? Am I going to be working on my distance control? What do you advise?
Warm-up should always be three-part. So distance, direction, and then part three would be just kind of setting your mind in play mode. So you actually take a putt, read it, go through your full routine, hit it just like you're about to play golf. Me personally, I'm going to start with distance. So I'll take one ball and I'll hit, let's say I've got 15 minutes. For 5 minutes, I'm just going around the green hitting putts as long as possible. 50-footers, 60-footers, 30-footers, very random, only one ball. Then the next five
do you
minutes,
pick
it, I'll
well,
take
wait, do you pick a target when you're doing that? I mean, you're not.
Yes, I am putting the balls.
Okay. Yeah, I do those long ones, but I pick I putt towards the fringe. I don't make the cup I just see, can I get it to the fringe all the way down there? Yeah.
And sometimes that's fine. The only time I would say be careful of that is if the fringes sort of have like a bowl.
Yeah.
Then everything would slow down. Or if there's a big runoff, if there's a false front or something. But if it's fairly uniform and tilt, then I think that's a great idea.
Okay.
Part two, I would have one ball and I would hit all these putts inside of 5 feet. So this would be all about face awareness, which is ultimately direction and putting. So I would hit a lot of short putts there. And then the final 5 minutes before I go to the tee, I would pick maybe a short putt, a medium putt, and a long putt. Read it, go through my full routine. I'm really trying to get into play mode from there, visualizing the ball roll and things like that. So I would try to cover each of those three areas in about 15 minutes.
Great.
And then you'll be ready to go. Yeah.
Awesome. Tim, tell us how people get in touch with you.
You can go to the website, oldwaverly.com, and click on Teaching Center, and then book a coaching session right there online. You can email me. My last name is Yelverton. So it is first initial T, Yelverton, YELVERTON, and then 2002 at Gmail. It's a long college email address that I still use. But so TYelverton2002 at Gmail, or you can book online at oldwaverly.com. So either one of those two ways is the easiest way to get in touch with me. And Fred, I appreciate you having me on your show. It was a blast talking with you.
You may have caught that I mentioned during the interview that this conversation is also available to watch at golfsmarter.com and at youtube.com/golfsmartertv. And please, if you're going to YouTube, type in Golf Smarter TV. You're going to find a channel full of videos that are tips and the interviews and equipment reviews, tech review, all kinds of things about golf, always about golf. Right there at Golf Smarter TV on YouTube. I've made this request before, right? Asking you to make a review on Golf Smarter. So, like, it's really different than punching up a radio station, right? You just punch it up, listen, punch it up, listen. You can go discovering that way. But podcasts need word of mouth to grow. And it's been truly amazing what it's done for Golf Smarter because of the reviews that we've received. It makes it come up first when there's doing a search. You should try this out. If you're in the iTunes app or the podcast app, the Apple one, go into the search, type in golf. Don't even hit return. Just type in golf and you're going to get predictive suggestions. The number one suggestion when you type golf comes up as Golf Smarter. That's huge for me. I don't know how it happened, but it's there and I'm not going to complain. So I really think it's because of all the kind things that have been said about Golf Smarter over the last 12 years and also with the frequency that we get new subscriptions. So please write a review for us. Really appreciate it. Now, to follow Golf Smarter and have an online conversation with myself and others in our global Golf Smarter community, please follow us at Golf Smarter on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And don't forget, we have a free Golf Smarter app. It works for both iOS or Android, and it's available now to get access to our entire archives and be notified when each new episode is available on your mobile device as soon as it's published. Find out all this information and everything about Golf Smarter at golfsmarter.com.